It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at the latest numbers on homicides in Milwaukee and how the city and its residents are responding to the increasing violence. First, a look at a controversial provision that was abruptly added to the state budget last week, exemptions to Wisconsin's open records law. On Thursday night, Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee introduced and passed those exemptions in a late-night session. But on Saturday, after outcry from left and right alike, Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislative leaders announced they would remove that open records overhaul from the budget. Patrick Marley's with us now to talk about what happened over the weekend, how Governor Walker's office is reacting. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
So let's do a quick recap. These exemptions to the state open records law, kind of a surprise in this what's called a 999 motion. What do we know about why they're included in this package?
Yeah, it's a total surprise. So the 999 motion is the last substantive motion that the Joint Finance Committee passes before sending it on to the full legislature. It's always full of all kinds. It's a grab bag of various things. There's usually some pork in it. There's always a couple of surprises in it. This year's big surprise was essentially an evisceration of the open records law that would have allowed state and local and school officials to withhold all kinds of records that show how they make the decisions they make, and would essentially give lawmakers a blanket exemption from having to disclose any information at all. They did this just before midnight on Thursday. We wrote about it. Other media wrote about it. They immediately were blasted by groups on the left and the right, and other open records advocates and Republicans who passed this were in quick retreat, and by Saturday said that they were entirely abandoning it.
So, yeah, did they say why it was being abandoned on Saturday so quickly after it was introduced in the first place?
They said that their intention was never to make government less transparent, which is it's unclear how they can maintain that because, you know, the plain language of the statute was to greatly weaken the open records law. They will not tell us what reason they thought that this was needed other than a few lawmakers made some comments about them thinking that it would clarify the law, make it easier for them to make sure that they were following the law. But they haven't really given us their rationale for it, and they certainly haven't told us who wrote it. You know, there are 12 Republicans on this committee who voted for it, and legislative leaders pushed it, but they say it came from multiple lawmakers. They won't tell us which one. No one will take ownership of it.
So I imagine reporters from around the state will be filing open records requests that
already
would be denied if this thing had been passed.
That's right. I mean, we put in our first open records request on Thursday and sort of thinking that it was possible we would never get answers to these questions because if they, you know, the budget's going to pass here in the next few days most likely, and if they put it into law, we wouldn't have access to those. We have now put in, you know, now they're saying they're going to pull it back. We've put in many open records requests. Now that's, you know, the public will only find out if the records actually reveal who was behind this. It's possible this was all done in conversations, or it turns out that lawmakers don't have to retain records, so if they quickly destroyed them before the records requests came in, we might not find out, but at least we have a chance now of finding out.
We're talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about open records laws in Wisconsin. They were changed in a Joint Finance Committee proposal on Thursday, passed by that committee, rejected after an outcry by Saturday. Patrick, you wrote a piece for the Journal Sentinel digging into how Governor Walker has approached public records requests in the recent past. In particular, his proposal to rewrite the Wisconsin idea that came through in the budget. It was called a drafting error later. How does that fit into this discussion?
So what's interesting here is that one of the proposals, there were many changes to the open records law that they advanced last week. One of them was to withhold what they call deliberative materials. So these are records that have to do with the internal discussions about how decisions are made. And if that had gone into place, like I say, there are a whole host of records you wouldn't get because you wouldn't get anything but the actual decision, none of the internal discussion up to that. And the governor is now saying that he doesn't support that and that they're not going to change the law. But the fact is, he has been withholding records in recent months for that very reason, stating that certain internal documents that have to do with the frank exchange of ideas and the candid discussions of his staff do not belong to the public, and don't have to be released. He's being sued. We've gotten denials based on that from his administration. Others have as well. He's got two lawsuits pending against him from the Progressive Magazine and the Center for Media and Democracy. I've talked to another individual today who's just an average citizen who made an open records request to the Department of Administration. He got a similar denial. So we don't know how many of these are out there. But for some time, the governor has been holding back records for these reasons that we haven't ever seen before.
And do we know what we don't know? How many records are being prevented from going out to the public this way?
We do not. To be clear, the governor has produced hundreds of other records, and what you get are these partial denials. So you get a pile of records, and you get a letter that says, here's what you asked for. I'm supplying these records, but I'm holding back other records for various reasons. They might say they're withholding cell phone numbers, or they're withholding the social security number of someone, or a personal address. And then now we're getting these requests, or having a couple cases or responses where they say that they're holding them back because of these internal deliberations. But they don't tell you that, are they holding back two documents or are they holding back 200? We just don't know.
Now, in the midst of all this, we've heard about a lawsuit from the MacGyver Institute toward Democratic Senator John Erpenbach. They're on the same side. They're against this open records change. But in the past, the Institute had sued Senator Erpenbach's office because they were not revealing all the information that they wanted. Is this just kind of the norm? I file an open records request. They push back. I sue them if I have the means and have to. Is that just the common way this works?
Yeah, and it's the open records law is set up in a way that you should be able to sue even if you don't have the means to do it. There's a fee recovery in there, so you should be able, if you have a decent case, to get a lawyer to take your case contingent upon they get paid if they win. So if, say, a school district withholds records that are clearly available to you under the open records law, you go to a lawyer, the lawyer files suit, you don't have to pay anything, you win the case. The judge says they should have released these records, and they got to pay the attorney his or her fees, and then they figure out how many hours they put into the case, and they're paid. So in the instance of the MacGyver Institute, they had asked for John Erpenbach's records related to emails that he received over the fight of Act 10. Erpenbach provided those, but blacked out the names of all the people who had emailed him. MacGyver said you got to release the names. They had a suit that went up to the state appeals court, and Erpenbach lost, and the MacGyver Institute got all its records, and taxpayers had to pay for the legal defense of in that case had to pay for Erpenbach's legal defense as well as the cost for MacGyver to bring its lawsuit.
Now, this open records change is out of the state budget, but Republican leaders evidently saying that the legislature will form a legislative council committee to explore amending open records laws. Do we know anything about how, when, what's going to happen with that?
Right. So first of all, I mean, technically, this is all still in the state budget. It was plugged into the budget by the Joint Finance Committee on Thursday, and now leaders have said they're taking it out, and their statement says in its entirety. But when we ask specifics about, well, what's coming out and what's not, they haven't answered yet. So it will take the next step in the process is for them to formally remove this, and we'll see what if they really pull everything out. And then they want to advance this legislative council study committee. So this would be a group that would involve legislators as well as members of the public appointed by legislative leaders. And they would study the open records law and figure out, do we need any changes? And if so, what should those be? And, if the committee could reach a conclusion, they would advance that to the legislature, which would then take it up as separate standalone legislation. They've done this in the past and been unable to agree. There have been a lot of technology changes since the open records law was adopted, and there's a lot of disagreement among fair-minded people over what should be available, what shouldn't. Text messages are not something that were contemplated when the open records law was invented.
That way of tackling the issue of open records might be a little less controversial, it seems, though, than what a lot of people perceived as an out-of-nowhere surprise sudden change, like we saw last Thursday.
Absolutely, because you'd see, you'd have public testimony, everybody would come forward, they would make their case to the committee, it would be, anybody in the public would be able to go and listen or to testify, get information. It would be done over a series of weeks or months. rather than just sort of sprung on the public with half an hour of debate and thrown into the budget at 11:30 at night.
And before I let you go, Patrick, you mentioned you have open records requests. Other people do, too, on the drafting of this change. Any idea what kind of timeline there might be before you get a response on that?
We don't know. The open records law says that records must be provided as soon as practicable and without delay. Sometimes that means a matter of days. Sometimes it means a matter of months. I would guess we're going to have to wait a couple of weeks at least. But some legislators should have files that are quickly identifiable and should be able to turn them around in a day or two. I mean, I would not be surprised if, you know, if some of these people have a small number of records, we should be able to have them by the end of the day today or within the next couple of days.
All right, Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, with us to talk about the news that Governor Walker and other state Republican leaders have removed the open records, or announced that they're going to remove the open records overhaul from the Wisconsin budget. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll trace the history of the long-running battle between bicyclists and motorists. A Wisconsin professor and self-described amateur cyclist goes back in time, finds that what we see maybe is modern current battles over who gets to use the road and how go back well over a century. And we're looking for your thoughts on that right now. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page if you are a bicyclist or a motorist. Let us know your perspective. Do you think one side or the other is hogging the road, breaking the rules? Share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, the ongoing effort to complete Wisconsin's budget is going on without one key element, funding for the Milwaukee Bucks Arena. That doesn't mean the deal is done. It was just taken out of the budget to make it a little easier to pass. Here now with the latest and a look ahead at what might happen on that topic this week, we have Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter. Sean, always good to talk to you.
Hey, Rob.
So what happened today? I understand there was a hearing today on the arena deal.
Yeah, there's a hearing still going on as we speak right now. And this may be the only hearing that we have for this Bucks Arena proposal that was kind of re-released about a month ago, taken out of the budget more recently. And this is not a public hearing. This is a hearing where the legislature's Joint Finance Committee is hearing testimony only from proponents of the plan. That list of proponents has included the Bucks president, Peter Fagan, the Milwaukee Chamber of Commerce, and Milwaukee's mayor, Milwaukee's county executive. So they're getting that side of the story here, but this isn't a chance for the public to kind of weigh in and say, you know, keep the Bucks or tell them to hit the road or anything like that.
So it sounds like this isn't a public hearing or a hearing in the conventional sense of the word. It may be a sales pitch from the leaders who support this plan trying to get members of the legislature who weren't currently ready to vote for this?
It has that feel to it, definitely. And there are just a lot of unknowns about this Bucks plan right now. We don't exactly know what kind of timeline the Bucks are operating on. Bucks President Peter Fagan was asked to give a firm, you know, crystal clear timeline on when the state of Wisconsin needed to pass this Bucks deal so that the Bucks could break ground in a timely way and that the NBA wouldn't, essentially take the franchise back and potentially move it to another city. The cities that Peter Fagan mentioned were Seattle or Las Vegas. So there's no exact firm deadline and when that needs to happen. And now that it's been taken out of the budget, legislators don't have that pressure hanging over them either. And there's also the unknown of where they're going to get the votes, because this is, now that it's not in the budget, it's no longer an issue that's going to get only Republican votes, or that majority Republicans are now trying to get Democrats to sign on to the plan, and Democrats had no hand in writing it. So pretty tricky issue here.
Now, you mentioned who's testifying, supporters, key supporters of this Bucks Arena deal, this plan. Who's the audience? Is this just Joint Finance members, or is it legislators at large here?
I think it's you know, there's joint finance members are the immediate audience. They did have a chance to ask quite a few questions of the legislature's nonpartisan budget office about this plan. So it's, you know, one name I didn't mention there. They're not a proponent or opponent of this, but they know all the details. And so, you know, you learn some facts like it's going to be 13 years before this Wisconsin Center District in Milwaukee will begin to pay off the debt associated with this plan. I think the audience largely is whoever's on the fence over this Bucks plan. And so, you know, you've got the proponents of this coming forward today. I can imagine that legislative leadership wants them to kind of put their best foot forward and get those people who might be on the fence, whether they be Republican or Democrat.
Talking to WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about the latest, the ongoing saga of the Milwaukee Bucks arena funding plan. It's out of the budget, but still in the legislature, trying to make the case, hearing today with supporters of the proposed deal with lots of public financing. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Are you hoping that the Bucks stay in Wisconsin? What's it worth to you? Is some public financing worth it to keep the team around or not? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sean, remind us, how much money are we talking coming from the public at various levels, state, county, and city?
Yeah, I guess it depends on where you stop counting. I mean, the basic initial investment from the state and the city of the state and the county is $55 million from the state, $55 million from the county. With interest, that'll grow to $80 million for the state and $80 million for the county. The county is going to get its share of that money by having the state collect debt that the county can't collect right now. So that is another very, you know, unusual piece of this financing plan that some people are skeptical about. Then you've got this Wisconsin Center District, which is currently operating a convention center in Milwaukee based on a variety of tourism taxes. The Wisconsin Center District was not represented today. They have a $93 million principal investment in this Bucks plan with interest. Their share of this will grow to $217 million. So that's a huge piece of this plan. That's where the actual taxes are associated with this plan. But you didn't have anybody from the Wisconsin Center District testifying today.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ralph is on the line in Milwaukee. Ralph, hi.
Good afternoon. I would like to comment that I don't think citizens, City of Milwaukee, County of Milwaukee, State of Wisconsin should pay a penny for this facility. For people who are almost billionaires and can afford to do this on their own penny, there's no reason to spend taxpayer money when, well, we've got the Milwaukee Miller Park over here that we're still paying for, and that's a 20-year-old issue. So.
Ralph, thanks a lot for the call. Sean, this is an argument that we're hearing from some Republicans and some Democrats. Isn't that right?
Well, I mean, the owners of the Milwaukee Bucks are among the wealthiest people in the world, according to Forbes magazine. So they likely, if they pooled their resources, certainly could build this on their own. And so I guess the case then that they make is that, well, in other states, you know, the state or the government share of an arena has actually been bigger. And so we're presenting you with the bargain here, Wisconsin. We're going to cover half of these costs. We're going to cover the cost overruns. This is actually a pretty good deal as it compares to other arena financing deals around the country. If you don't compare it to those other deals around the country, though, and if you just kind of look at the principle of the thing, you do have, in the end, the, you know, three units of government here that are paying for half of an arena, and you know, the people who are going to primarily benefit from it are already very wealthy.
The governor and other people who signed on to this deal and its release, their motto was something like "cheaper to keep them." Who do they have to persuade that that's true in the legislature to get this vote? Because it doesn't sound like it's necessarily going to be a straight-up Republican majority pushing this through.
Yeah, you have not heard, at least I didn't hear when I was in there, the phrase cheaper to keep them was not resurrected today. So okay. that may be something that they've moved beyond. They're not making a very romantic pitch, though. I mean, they're not trying to say, at least the governor's office hasn't been trying to say that this is going to make Wisconsin a shining city on the hill. Their entire pitch has been just look at the final financial aspects of this, that you are going to lose tax revenue if the Milwaukee Bucks leave town. And those player salaries upon which we're collecting income taxes right now, the executive salaries, those all go away. And so their pitch all along has been that, you just got to look at that as the money we would lose. And that's the reason that you should support the Bucks deal. That the governor's office has is going to have a hard time selling that to every legislator, though. I mean, today, Representative Dean Knutson was talking about that, and some of the revenue projections associated with this deal is fuzzy math. He said they're hocus-pocus,
wow.
wild-eyed optimism. And that's a Republican member of the legislature's budget committee, so not everyone's going to be on
right.
board with this.
More to come on that, Sean. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome, Rob.
It's WPR's own Sean Johnson talking about the Milwaukee Bucks funding deal. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Anytime the conversation turns to bicyclists and motorists sharing the road, it never seems to go that well. As more cyclists hit the streets these days, as commuters or recreational riders, the possibility for conflict with cars seems greater than ever. The two sides aren't afraid to speak their minds against each other. But according to our next guest, today's debate about bikes on roads is not a new one. Throughout history, bikes and vehicles, from horse-drawn carriages to the cars of today, have always been at odds on the road. But as today's bike boom continues, shows no signs of slowing down in coming years, is there a solution that can make the road work for everyone? Here with us now is James Longhurst. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, and the author of Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road. James, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So when you're talking about bike battles, what kind of things are we talking about over the decades?
Well, one thing I'm not talking about is sort of the language we have right now about the war of cars versus bikes. And that's not what I meant when I came up with the title for the book. What I really wanted to talk about was battles over bikes, when governments, particularly on the city and the state level, for the last century and a half, have made decisions about what role bikes were going to have in transportation and in recreation and commuting. And so it's really a book that's about battles over the bike and battles over how we design the city as a place we live and work at the same time.
And a big point of your book, it seems, is that that other kind of bike battle, the daily conflict between car and bicyclist, is set on a landscape, on a turf that was established over that history and all these little decisions, sometimes big decisions, over how we build our infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's definitely the curse of the historian is most normal people can wander through their lives and see the landscape around them and sort of assume either that things were always this way or that they were intended to be this way. And historians can, through really getting immersed in the sources from the past, see how very different either the past was just a mere couple of decades ago or how different it was intended to be. And the road as we have it now, as largely the province of automobiles and of personal automobiles, that's a very recent creation. And the design of the streets as we have them, the intersections, the signage, the laws, the rules of the road, as it were, are incredibly recent creations. And it's easy when we have debates today about what is the bicycle and what is its role in transportation to assume that things were always the way that we see them now. And that's really not the case.
Well, let's go back to the dawn of time, as it regards bicycles anyway. What were some of those first debates and decisions that had to be made, even before we were talking about, you know, internal combustion engines powering vehicles on the road?
Well, that's one of the things that in your introduction I was thinking about immediately, because you started by talking about bicycles and vehicles. And that's one of the first bicycle battles I talk about in the book, is that vehicles are a legal category. And it's a word we recognize, but it's also something that lawyers use to write laws to control and regulate. And the word vehicle has a legal definition, and it's something that existed long before the internal combustion vehicle. And when the bicycle first came along, the first fight was about, is this new technology, is this new way of getting around, does it fit in that category of legal vehicle? And that was a very high-stakes debate. And this is, we're talking really in the 1870s and 1880s, and these are bicycles that you and I would be a little terrified to see. These are things called the penny farthing or the ordinary or the high wheel. And a lot of the time in those decades, they were just called the wheel because they were an enormous front wheel, terrifying, no brakes, really only to be operated by young men and other human beings without common sense. And when these things started getting into trouble on the roads, they started going faster, causing accidents or causing injury. This became the first bike battle to come before the courts. And this is one of the first realizations I had, was that the courts and political institutions before them had a definition of what the road was as a commons, as a shared public resource, that there were, in fact, before the automobile, and in fact, now with the automobile, the road is a common pool resource that is used by many, many unalike road users, pedestrians, public transit, bicycles, personal automobiles, motorcycles, mopeds, segways, Prius and electric vehicles, and my goodness, soon autonomous vehicles, but also in the past, trolleys and omnibuses and hacks and carriages. And the road has existed in law for centuries and even millennia as a commons. And it's this first, when the bicycle comes along, the legal question is, will it be allowed into the commons as an equal user, or does it create a nuisance for other users that should eliminate it? And in fact, in those first debates in the 1870s and 1880s, the bicycle is included in the list of legal vehicles, and it's included in the list of legal vehicles before the automobile ever exists, and in ways that set legal precedent for the automobile to be added as a vehicle later.
Now, before we move on from that era, I've got to ask you to tell the story of Absalom Wyckoff, a pre-car, horse and buggy rider, horse and wagon rider, who really didn't like these bikes.
And this is a story out of Chicago, and I still can't tell for the life of me. This is a newspaper story from the Chicago Daily Tribune, and I still can't tell if this journalist was reporting truth as he saw it or spinning a bit of a parable about many different conflicts that they saw on the road. And this is a farmer. He is on the dirt roads of the time, and he has a great antipathy towards cyclists, and he declares that he's going to whip them in when he sees them, and he just happens to horse whip the wrong cyclist, who dismounts, lays his bike down neatly, jumps up, takes away the whip, and becomes whipping Farmer Absalom. And it's told as a parable, as if the farmer at the end has been taught his lesson. But I found it as one of many stories where different road users order each other out of the road, to they declare each other to be unfair impositions on the public trust or the public good. And I found countless newspaper stories about farmers producing sawed-off shotguns and pointing them at automobile drivers and yelling, "Now stop tooting, dang ye," at people who are honking at them too much. And this is evidence, this might be disturbing, and it might be sort of evidence that we've always fought over the road, but it's evidence to me as a historian that what we have here is actually a very important debate over the public good and who has fair claim onto this resource, this shared resource of the road.
Talking to James Longhurst from UW-La Crosse about his new book, Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road. Well, there have been efforts to make that resource a little less scarce over the years, James. Obviously, a lot more roads than there were 150 years ago. And bikes, as I understand it from your book, were part of the, and bikers, bicyclists, were part of the impetus to pave roads and actually try to get a network of paved bike paths around the country.
And there's actually two different movements here as we move from the first terrifying high wheel to the bicycle that you and I would recognize and we could even ride if we were transported to the 1890s. You or I could ride what was then known as the safety bicycle, which is a bicycle with two wheels of equal size and a rear chain-driven wheel, no brakes, a fixed gear. And so we could ride that, and if somebody from the 1890s was transported forward to the present, they could ride the cool urban fixed gear of today. And also they would have the same facial hair as a urban hipster. So as we move into the 1890s, the limitation on this, the first great bike boom of American history, probably one among three or four, and we're in the third or the fourth right now, depending on how you count them. And this, the 1890s was the great bicycle boom. And the limitation was the roads were terrible. The roads are unpaved. They're not professionally engineered. They're mostly dirt or compacted roads outside of cities. And it's not like the automobile is the traffic pushing the bike out of the road. There are no automobiles of note. And so cyclists in this great all-consuming fad of the 1890s, as everyone, particularly the high-class elites, pick up bicycling as recreation, they're looking for a solution, how to create bicycles or roads for bicycles. And the first they come up with is what's known as the Good Roads Movement. And the Good Roads Movement is an example of great advertising and naming, because what it really is a movement to convince Americans to pay for roads out of taxing themselves. But that doesn't sell as well as good roads. Because before this point in time, roads are built by those who live or do business on them, the abutters, not out of general taxation. So the Good Roads Movement isn't going to have much success in the middle of the 1890s. And some cyclists turn to a separate plan, what they call the side path movement, like a sidewalk, which had been built for pedestrians starting really in the middle of the 19th century in America. But a side path, a separate bicycle-specific network protected in state law with county-level commissions to collect first taxes and then later user fees like a tag or some sort of NPR tote bag, perhaps. Out of which those funds would be used to build bicycle-specific paths. The side path movement had a great deal of success upstate New York, Rochester, building hundreds of miles, Minneapolis and St. Paul, hundreds of miles of side path networks, and states across the Union passing these side path laws. But as the bike boom faded, the user fees dried up. It would have been a disaster, except the Good Roads Movement was finally seeing some success, and cyclists were delighted because they thought, wow, we're going to have now these paved roads for our use, and automobiles weren't really numerous yet. So at that moment, side paths were simply paved over where they existed, and cyclists looked forward to a new shared paved road system that they would use in common with other road users. And that seems to be the conflict we've set up today.
Talking right now with James Longhurst, author of the new book, Bike Battles, about the history of cars and bikes and other vehicles sharing the road. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see happen to make everybody be able to use the road? Do you think we need to change the way we set up our roads? More amenities for bicyclists on the road, separate paths, bring back these side paths that our guest was just talking about. Whether you're a motorist, a cyclist, a little of both, like to know what you think. At 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation, move into some modern day debates after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about bike battles, the history of cars and bikes sharing the American road. Cyclist and UW lacrosse professor James Longhurst is our guest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about cars and bicycles sharing the road, the current state of affairs? Is there enough room for everyone? Should cars be given priority? Do bikes need more things to help them out? What policies do you think can make the road safer for everyone? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'll go right to a caller. We've got Eric on the phone in Vilas County. Eric, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, we've got a phenomenal set of paved bike paths up here in Oneida County, and they're well complicated issue a little bit because they're not really well suited for all types of biking. So we've got large groups of road bikers that will be out doing 18, 20 miles an hour. And there's a bike path right nearby that's being used by families with Fido and kids on tricycles. And the motorists, therefore, become almost a little more hostile towards folks that are using the roads within the legal parameters for riding in groups or riding in pace lines or just socially riding when the bike path is 30 feet off. They were stuck between being a hazard on the bike path and being a hazard on the road.
Eric, thanks a lot. Eric, thanks for the call. At James, he's bringing us up now up to the 21st century. As you said, we're in the midst of a big bike boom. Are conflicts like the one Eric mentioned, gray areas like that, pretty common today?
Well, Eric brought us up to the 21st century. I'm immediately going to throw us backwards because as a historian, I think that what I can bring to understanding our current the nickname we have for this is the bike lash, that we're in the middle of this historic increase in cycling, both recreational and commuting. And at the same time, as we rebuild cities to respond to that, there's a backlash. Again, it's political, it's cultural, and we nickname it bike lash. But I'm gonna throw it backwards into history and say the division that Eric brings up is both between recreational and transportational cycling, and also between the ideas of separated versus combined infrastructure. And I'll do the cowardly historian's route and say we have had this discussion repeatedly. And in a lot of ways, I think one of the things I can say usefully as a historian to help us understand why the bike lash is so extreme, because it really kind of is unhinged. It's if you read the letters to the editor in a newspaper or the responses in a Facebook post or discussions about the return of the bicycle and the sharing of the public road, I think that debates over use of a shared resource would be expected. But we have some really extreme responses. And as a scholar, I wanted to understand why that is. And I think Eric's pointing us into this direction, that the fact that historically we've talked about bicycling as if it's one thing. And so if somebody responds in a letter to the editor and they say, well, bikers should do this, or I think the bike means this, or the bike is just this, quite often we're speaking different languages. Some people could be talking about recreational and highly skilled athletes in pace lines, and some people could be talking about 8-year-olds, and some people could be talking about a very expensive $10,000 full carbon frame, and some other people could be talking about a $25 Walmart bike, which is someone's lifeline and their only access to their work schedule or to a nearby grocery store. And yet somehow the word bicycle applies to all of these things: recreational, transportational, commuting, on-road, off-road, dirt bike, road bike, tricycle. And so this, I think, is one of the useful things I as a historian can do is point out that all this history has been rolled up and it's not never quite clear what people are referring to when they have that discussion.
Well, looking at the lessons from history as we come near the end of the conversation, are there ideas here, this idea of a commons maybe that can maybe not solve everything, but given the roadways we have now, make things work a little bit better, a little bit more civilly, and a little bit more safely?
Well, the positive thing I take about from talking about the commons is a lot of people who think about the commons think about the tragedy of the commons, the idea that we instinctively or overuse a shared resource. And more environmental scholars have been thinking, instead of the tragedy of the commons, about the triumph of the commons, that when you have a shared resource, human societies traditionally have figured out ways to deal with it. It takes some time. And one thing about the road as it is with the automobile on it, it's really only existed really in its current form for less than a century. And so we're still debating what that shared commons will be. I think that we probably will be able to share things better, mostly because I'm an optimist and I'd really not like to be run over, if that's at all a possibility, please.
Well, good luck with that as you cycle the rest of the summer away. James, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's James Longhurst. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Bike Battles: A History of Sharing the American Road.